You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the once fierce British press has already had its tail between its legs, now it could be about to be declawed.
The press needs to establish a new regulatory body which is truly independent of industry leaders and of government and of politicians.
Lord Justice Leveson has published his report today into the culture of the British press. We ask if anyone's going to listen to him. And now that the UK's introducing a minimum price for alcohol, we take a look at the different tactics for controlling alcohol consumption, which work and which don't. And ahead of a new Nordic film festival in London, we talk about the success of Nordic cinema like this.
Jeg husker første gangen jeg kom til Oslo, så opplevde jeg en sånn enorm frihetsfølelse.
Jeg husker veldig godt latteren hans.
Jeg husker lukten av håret hennes når vi hadde vært på stranden.
And we head to a town in northern Sweden that's trying to cheer people up by installing therapy lights in bus stops. We'll listen to some music too. Lots to come then in the next hour here on Midori House. Before all of that, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Ultra-nationalists have protested today against the Palestinian bid for limited statehood at the United Nations, where voting on that proposal will take place later tonight. Right-wing Jewish protesters like lawmaker Aya Idad tried to burn a Palestinian flag outside the UN's headquarters in Jerusalem.
Tonight we will take a symbolic measure of burning the flag of the Palestinian Authority when we say there's only one entity in the land of Israel. This is the state of Israel, the Jewish Zionist state of Israel. We will never agree to any foreign statehood other than the state of Israel in our homeland.
Two Pakistani girls shot by a Taliban hit squad trying to kill their classmate Malala Yousafzai returned to school today under tight security. Yousafzai campaigned for girls' education despite threats from the Taliban, and on the 9th of October a gunman shot her in the head as she was leaving her school in Pakistan's Swat Valley. The head of the United Nations nuclear agency, Yukiya Amano, said there had been no progress in a year-long push to find out if Iran was developing an atomic bomb. He called for urgent efforts to end Tehran's standoff with the West.
We have not been able to reach agreement with Iran on what is known as the structured approach to resolving outstanding issues. In the meantime, Iran has continued to enrich uranium up to 5% and 20% and has expanded its enrichment capacity.
Meanwhile, the UN Arab League peace envoy Lakhdar Brahimi said the situation in Syria is deteriorating and that he believed the only way to enforce a ceasefire is with a UN peacekeeping mission.
The situation is bad in Syria and getting worse. That unfortunately the parties themselves are not ready to have an internal solution. The region is also not really capable at this time of helping for a peaceful solution. The place where a peaceful solution can be initiated is the Security Council.
Here in the UK, an inquiry has today called for a radical overhaul of how Britain's notoriously aggressive press should be governed. Lord Justice Brian Leveson, who led the inquiry, said there should be a new independent self-regulatory body, which crucially would be recognised in law.
It would enshrine, for the first time, a legal duty on the government to protect the freedom of the press. Secondly, it would provide an independent process to recognise the new self-regulatory body and thereby reassure the public of its independence and efficacy. Thirdly, it would provide new and tangible benefits for the press.
And finally, the day after Pope Benedict's latest book, The Infancy Narratives, Jesus of Nazareth, was published, Vatican officials found some headlines they were not expecting, with newspapers today even claiming that the Pope had banned Christmas. Other papers claimed that Benedict had snubbed traditions such as animals in nativity scenes. In the book, the Pope states that in the Gospels there is no reference to the presence of animals in the stable where Jesus was born. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
So you're saying that the animals weren't really there?
That's what he's saying.
That is some... I mean, given my Christmas spirit was on the rise, that's some pretty shocking news for this time of year.
That's what he says in his book. He says some other things that they're all uptight about, getting quite extreme about it. But I think actually, he's just saying in where Jesus was actually born, there were no animals there. It doesn't mean you can't have nativity scenes, are
they? Yeah, you're not going to take my donkey away from me with your news bulletin, Jonathan.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. We will see you in just under half an hour. It is 6 minutes past six here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The proper Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. It started with a shocking scoop that a journalist hacked into the phone of a schoolgirl who'd been murdered before her parents even knew she was dead. That revelation triggered a report that took 18 months to research, 5 months to write. It runs to 2,000 pages and took contributions from Hollywood royalty, pop starlets and the most powerful people in politics. The Leveson Inquiry report has at last been delivered, as we've been hearing. Now the question is whether or not it will be listened to. British newspapers have unsurprisingly spent days preempting the findings. They guessed correctly, it seems, that he'd recommend legislation to control the press. They were also right that the report would cause a crack in the ruling coalition. So is the world's fiercest newspaper industry about to have its claws clipped? And what will that mean for press freedoms around the world? Well, Charlie Beckett is director of the Journalism and Society think tank Polis at the London School of Economics, Media and Communications Department. Welcome to Midori House, Charlie. Perhaps you could start by expanding for us on what exactly this key point that everyone's been talking about statutory regulation or not. Where exactly has he come down on this? And talk to us about the word statutory as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is completely the crux of the issue. Unfortunately, there is not a simple answer. I have been speaking to any number of experts at the LSE and elsewhere, and I've gone through the report myself, and I still find it contradictory because Lord Justice Leveson himself says this is not and cannot be characterized as statutory regulation of the press, and yet he is proposing a body, a self-regulatory body, which is going to be independent, a board of fine people, not journalists, who are going to lay down the law, as it were. And it will be a law because that board will have the backup of statutory oversight. Ofcom is going to be the backstop for it. So when is statutory not statutory? And I think, strangely, the Prime Minister has sort of recognised this with his Rubicon metaphor.
Explain that for us.
Well, it's sort of you can't be a little bit pregnant, I think it is, which is basically, you can't be a bit statutory or you can't be second-hand statutory. As soon as politicians start to set down law, then you have a particular kind of regulation. Now, in broadcasting, I worked in the BBC and ITN for 20 years, we were subject to statutory regulation. And if that's what you want, that's fine. But it does mean you get a different kind of journalism. In the BBC, for example, you get journalism which has to be, by law, balanced. And it mustn't take so many risks. So you end up with a much less raucous, much less partisan. and some would say much less investigative, much less critical kind of media. And you know, you only have to think back to MPs' expenses to think that, yes, gosh, sometimes it's quite good to have journalists who are prepared to, you know, go against the flow and be a bit rude and counter establishment.
It does seem, in fact, that the witness that came to mind over this debate, over the sort of word statutory and whether or not it applies, was Hugh Grant when he took the stand. He made a big deal about the fact that there needed to just be a dab of statute to back this up, which seems to be sort of confusing things syntactically a little bit. So we don't know exactly what the proposed body will look like then. What about who's got a black mark against their name and who doesn't? It seems that David Cameron and Jeremy Hunt have both been found innocent of any wrongdoing here. Is that fair?
That's right. I mean, I think, again, it's so strange, this inquiry, which, do you remember, was originally supposed to be into the actual crime of phone hacking and how that happened and turned into this sprawling kind of political investigation and into things like, you know, why was Cameron texting Rebecca Brooks and what was the role of Jeremy Hunt in with Murdoch and so on. And in fact, on some of those tastier stories, if you like, certain people have been cleared. Certainly Jeremy Hunt has been cleared of any evidence of bias. But it's still a political hot potato. And what's going to be fascinating is, you know, I'd be interested in what your listeners think. Do they think, well done, David Cameron, for sticking up press freedom? Or do they think, nasty David Cameron, sticking up for those evil tabloid types? So I'm not quite sure where the political gain is. People say they don't like journalists, but then they go and buy the newspapers, and more importantly, they don't like politicians even more.
Well, this is one of the issues that's been raised as an argument for there to be a sort of new version of the PCC, a new version of self-regulation. What about press freedoms worldwide, then? This is what people are concerned about, that Britain is a sort of bastion of press freedom, and if we start doing something like this, then in the hands of dictators, that sort of precedent could be rather dangerous.
Yeah, I think that can be a bit hysterical. I mean, you know, I don't think we're heading for a sort of Cuba situation or North Korea. I think it's more that you'll have a different character of media. And of course, if you're an American, you are completely puzzled by this whole thing. They have no regulation at all, apart from, you know, libel laws and so on. They have defamation laws, of course. But otherwise, there's the First Amendment, which says, you know, freedom of expression, and the rest is left to the market, pretty much. So they're puzzled from one end of the spectrum. And at the other end, you've got you know, situations, say, France, where government actually subsidizes newspapers and where you've got a much more close, I'll put it politely, intimate relationship between politicians and journalists. You don't have that kind of mixture that you have in Britain where, yep, we've seen politicians hand in glove with proprietors. That's not good. On the other hand, you do have journalists prepared to give politicians a good kicking at times.
Well, what about then the newspapers which are traditionally very strongly in favour of the right-hand side of the political spectrum? Yeah. What sort of situation might we being set up here if the Prime Minister, who has had their support in getting into office, now has to clamp down on them? How might that relationship change?
Well, you know, he's done the right thing from their point of view. He's been, some would say, surprisingly straight on this. You know, he's accepted there should be tougher regulation in detail, but on the statutory principle, he's made it pretty clear that he doesn't want that. So I think in that sense, he's seen as a hero of the Conservative press tonight. Of course, there is a spectrum. You know, The Guardian and The Independent were also against statutory in principle, but they were in favour of quite tough independent regulation elsewhere. So I think there is a little bit of wiggle room, you know, that you know, Ed Miliband may end up getting some kind of support from the more left-wing papers, at least. But yeah, certainly the newspapers are furious tonight. They're furious with Leveson. They're having a hard time economically. They've done their best to behave over the last couple of years while he's been having his inquiry with Robert Jay, you know, quizzing them, making them look silly at times. And they've had enough of it, frankly. They would like to get back to business.
Charlie Beckett, thank you very much for enlightening us on that. That's Charlie Beckett, the director of the Journalism and Society think tank Polis at the LSC. We continue with this same theme and take a look now at how media is controlled in other countries right after this.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models, and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
For the latest episode, we don our thermals and take a trip to Iceland to see how the volcanic isle is recovering from its economic catastrophe.
It's easy to start something new in Iceland. It's easy to get help from others. It's a small and very close community.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, as we've been hearing, the Leveson report may change the way the media is controlled in the UK. Let's continue now with a more global outlook and hear what some of our Monocle correspondents outside the British bubble had to say about press regulation on their patch and how it impacts their ability to work with freedom and independence. On today's briefing, they spoke to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. First, Monocle correspondent Justin Bergman, who talked about the situation in China and in Singapore.
Both countries rank very low on the freedom of the press rankings. Actually, Singapore, surprisingly, is so far down on the list. They're below countries like South Sudan and Guinea-Bissau, which shows just how unfree the press is here. And, you know, I think there are many similarities between the countries, but where they differ is how they exercise control. China obviously has a very systematic system of controls on the internet. They also have frequently harassed journalists, imprisoned journalists. Journalists are frequently targeted for physical violence. Whereas in Singapore, what the government seems to do a lot of the time is just use the threats of legal action in order to force journalists here to self-censor themselves, which you see happening more so than you do in China. In China, you actually see quite a bit of journalists taking chances and trying to question the government quite a bit on corruption and things like that in some sorts of the media.
Mm. Just going back to where you're sitting at the moment in Singapore, it does strike me, and when I've been interviewed by journalists at the Straits Times, and of course, that's obviously really the paper of record, if not the only paper, you could almost argue, just the level of self-censorship that even occurs at a very basic level. So whether you're a cub reporter or otherwise, it doesn't even have to go up to sort of the heavy hand of the editor-in-chief or just people to curb their questions and be very measured about what they say.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's so bad that when I talk to young journalists here, they're just completely, they're just not passionate about the media. They find it all to be quite a joke. They know that their government is controlling everything that comes out in the press, and so they just don't see a way of stopping it or changing it. They're very disillusioned, and even see it in journalism schools in Singapore. There's only one university that offers a journalism program, and when I talk to a professor at that program, he says the students don't question anything, that they're being brought up in this system that doesn't teach how to question.
That was Monocle correspondent Justin Bergman with disillusionment in China and Singapore. So to India next, Rahul Bedi, journalist based in New Delhi, had this to say.
India has, as you said, a fairly vibrant press, but over the last 5 or 10 years, things have got a bit wobbly. There has been cases of repression. Recently, a cartoonist, in fact, was imprisoned in Bombay for coming out with the political cartoons. And as you mentioned, television broadcasts are becoming very shrill and raucous. And there is a great move, in fact, to try and regulate them. And this, in fact, manifested itself when there was the attack on Mumbai about 4 years ago, when terrorists seized a hotel and a Jewish center and attacked a very crowded railway station. At that time, there was a lot of talk about bringing about some laws to regulate television journalism, but it hasn't happened yet, but it's still not off the cards, and it could well take place over the next few months or years.
Mm. And just in the realm of social media as well, there's been a case with some arrests of two girls for something that was posted on a social media site, which I guess wasn't really that inflammatory, but nevertheless, it saw the girls get the nick.
Yes, the social media is actually something that the Indian establishment is grappling with, and it doesn't really understand. And in fact, it uses a lot of the laws which are fairly sort of neutral, as it were. They're not very clearly defined, to harass people and to oppress people. And these two girls were arrested for posting something which was perfectly innocuous. And although there has been an outcry against this, In fact, only recently yesterday, there was another case of somebody being arrested similarly for posting something very, very harmless and innocuous. So this is an area of great concern, and it's something that India is grappling with because technology has outstripped legal measures to deal with these, and the laws that are in place are very opaque.
And Earl, just before we go, I mean, how active is the discussion, let's say, in the trade media, where journalists and editors are having their dialogue, but as much, you know, in the media pages or on media programs of the networks, is at least there an active probing discussion going on about this?
Yes, there's a very active. In fact, as we speak, two journalists were arrested yesterday for trying to run a sting operation against a very prominent businessman and member of parliament. And there's a huge, huge outcry. In fact, all the television stations are pretty obsessed by these two arrests because it could happen to anybody tomorrow or day after. So there is a huge outcry and there is a very lively and vibrant discussion. But where it will lead really is anybody's guess.
So vibrant discussions then from New Delhi. That was Rahul Bedi. And next we're going to go to South Africa. Our woman in Cape Town is Alex Duval-Smith.
There's a lot of talk of introducing an insult law. The call has come this week from the General Secretary of the South African Communist Party, which is part of the government alliance, a call for an insult law. This would ban people like cartoonists and comedians from poking fun at President Jacob Zuma. Laws banning people from insulting heads of state exist in a number of countries like Zimbabwe, Angola, and Egypt until recently. And every few weeks, something pops up lampooning the polygamous President Jacob Zuma. This week, a television commercial was banned from the state broadcaster SABC before it was even flighted, actually. The ad was for a fish and chips company, and the animated ad poked fun at the large amounts of food consumed at Nkandla, which is President Zuma's compound in KwaZulu-Natal. Until very recently, President Zuma was trying to sue cartoonist Zapiro. Zapiro is the man who came up with the showerhead, showerhead being an illusion. Whenever he draws Zuma, he draws him with the head of a shower on top of his head, an allusion to the rape trial at which President Zuma said he avoided getting HIV by taking a shower.
And is it just from, let's say, at the leadership level, but does one get a sense that there's also, you know, coercion, you know, against the press also from, of course, some of the very powerful sectors, which are, of course, very important to the South African economy? Or is it really sort of just, you know, living at a political level?
Much living at a political level and very active at a political level. I mean, the talk of an insult law is quite new. Over the last few months, we've had talk of the introduction of a secrecy bill. That's actually very close to being signed into law now. The secrecy bill is quite worrying. It will strip journalists of the right to protect their sources, and it'll attach prison sentences of up to 25 years to the act of whistleblowing. So constitutional experts and groups like Human Rights Watch say the bill is essentially being created to allow the ANC to cover up corruption. The ANC is also pushing for the creation of a media appeals tribunal that would be state-run and that could impose hefty fines on journalists.
That was Alex Duval-Smith concluding our whistle-stop tour of global attitudes towards press freedom. She was talking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. Longer opening hours, increased taxes, better health, education, all of these things have been hailed at one point as the answer to the question of how to stop British people drinking till they hurt themselves. None of them, though, has worked. So the coalition government's latest alcohol-based magic bullet is minimum pricing. The idea is that if Britain's problem drinkers have to pay at least 45p for a unit of alcohol, that's about 70 US cents, they'll be priced out of their problem. The plans have got the drinks industry in the UK worried, of course, and they've got everyone else presuming the plans will fail. So what lessons are there for British policymakers from around the world? Well, we're joined on the line in a second by Victoria Scott, a journalist based in Qatar, and in a moment we'll be talking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie and David Michon to see if Finland and Canada respectively have any answers. But to Victoria first, welcome to Midori House. Could you just outline for us what the alcohol policy is in Qatar? Because it's not exactly illegal. What is the legal stance?
No, it's not actually illegal, though if you're drinking in public or drunk in public, that is illegal. And drink driving is absolutely, not acceptable, zero alcohol in the blood. But the situation, it's a Muslim country, obviously, and we're right next door to Saudi, which is very, very restrictive. And Qatar is significantly more liberal, but still, normal expats like me, we have to have a license which allows us to go to a supermarket. There is one supermarket in Doha, in Qatar, that sells alcohol.
It's a very busy supermarket, I presume.
It's very busy, yeah. Actually, it closes during Ramadan for 1 month every year, so it's only open for 11 months. So there's huge queues just before Ramadan. And it is something that you have to get used to. And in fact, your employer has a say as to whether you get a license or not. They have to produce a no objection letter for you to say that you're allowed to actually go and buy alcohol. And once you have your license, you can only buy 10% of your salary in alcohol every month.
Okay, so
for a lot of expats, it's quite a lot.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but yeah, clearly you're painting a picture of a very sort of very tight restrictions on the control of alcohol. What effect does that have on the drinking culture? You know, I know you can talk from an expat point of view. What effect has it had for you and your cohorts?
Well, I mean, also, the other point is that in five-star hotels, alcohol is sold. So you can go out to a bar like you would at home and drink on a weekend. And that happens, although it is very, very expensive, almost prohibitively so. You know, you wouldn't want to be doing it every week. So I think, I mean, talking from my own perspective, I drink much less here than I would do in the UK, because even if we go to our special supermarket and buy a bottle of wine, it's going to be £8 or £9, which is, you know, a fairly expensive bottle of wine. So, you know, you savour it, you don't overdo it. I don't see many examples of binge drinking out here amongst my fellow expats.
Victoria, thank you for painting that very useful picture for us. We're going to move now to representatives from Finland and Canada, from Midori House, Markus Hippi and David Michon. We heard there, gentlemen, that in Qatar there's a combination of price restrictions, legal restrictions, ties to your employer. How describe for us the drinking culture in Finland, Markus, and how they control things there.
I think it's quite well known that Finns like their drink, and I think it's partly because it's kind of a forbidden fruit. First of all, there is a state monopoly on who can sell alcohol any stronger than your normal regular beer. There are these alcohol shops that are very common. It's not difficult to find one, but anyway, it's state controlled that way. Secondly, the taxes are very high for alcohol in Finland. Mm. And thirdly, the discussion that seems to be never-ending in Finland is that when should bars close the latest?
The point that we're not saying here is that sort of historically Finland seems to be the one country that's held up as even worse than Britain in terms of binge drinking. Is that fair?
That is fair. And the Finnish taxation policy has been quite different according to times. It was about 6-7 years ago when Finland all of a sudden dropped alcohol taxes only because Estonia was joining the European Union.
And what effect did that have?
It was fear that all the Finns would go there and buy the alcohol, so Finland wouldn't get any tax money anymore. Well, so we lowered the taxes. As a result, Finns drank even more.
Right. Okay. Canada then. Mr. Michon, what's the lay of the land there?
Well, there's quite a diversity in terms of people's attitudes towards alcohol in Canada. The provinces, of which there are 10, control kind of the sale of alcohol. There's a few provinces that have either a mixed kind of government only plus private selling of alcohol, some which have fully privatized selling of alcohol, obviously controlled in some element by the government. And that kind of also reflects just people's attitudes towards drinking. So, for example, in Quebec, which, you know, you can buy beer kind of at corner shops, you know, in cities like Montreal, public drinking is much more tolerated, and they have a much more kind of continental European attitude towards drinking. It's much more part of kind of an everyday, every meal.
They sort of treat it like grown-ups, essentially.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? The continental attitude. This was the thing that was brought in the UK. They said, let's have bars open 24 hours a day, and then we'll have this continental culture. Of course, people just drank for 24 hours a day. So where do you think that comes from, that sort of responsibility? Is it in Canadian culture to give young people, you know, wine at the age of 10 or something?
No, it absolutely It absolutely isn't.
Watered down with a meal?
You know, one thing about, I guess, drinking in Canada, they are massive consumers of beer, that's for sure. But, you know, you unlike the UK, you would never really consider drinking without having a meal first. I think that's the most distinct difference.
Whereas in the UK, people deliberately starve themselves so they can get drunk more quickly,
cheaper,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I haven't been a student for a while, but that sounds fairly familiar. Marcus, any final words?
Any final words? Well, once again, this forbidden fruit. Finnish kids are quite often looking for people who could buy beer for them from the shops because that is considered to be so exciting as an idea, you know. They okay. get this grown-up feeling when they get to buy alcohol.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure we've solved it, but it's certainly interesting to get both of your perspectives. David Michon and Marcus Hippie, thank you very much. Before that, we heard from Victoria Scott in Qatar. In a moment, we will be having the news, but first, here's a little bit of music. Summer Camp, this is Better Off Without You. That was Summer Camp. In the next half hour of the programme, we will talk about the rise of the Nordic film industry. We'll review new aviation technology that could potentially change the way we fly in the future. And we'll be talking about how to cheer up Swedish people using bus stops. First up, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much, Dominic. Ultra-nationalists have protested today against the Palestinian bid for limited statehood at the United Nations, where voting on that proposal will take place later tonight. Right-wing Jewish protesters tried to burn a Palestinian flag outside the UN's headquarters in Jerusalem. Two Pakistani girls shot by a Taliban hit squad trying to kill their classmate returned to school today under tight security. The head of the United Nations nuclear agency said there had been no progress in a year-long push to find out if Iran was developing an atomic bomb, calling for urgent efforts to end Tehran's standoff with the West. The UN Arab League peace envoy Lakhdar Brahimi said the situation in Syria is deteriorating and that he believed the only way to enforce a ceasefire is with a UN peacekeeping mission. Here, an inquiry has today called for a radical overhaul of how Britain's notoriously aggressive press should be governed. Lord Justice Brian Leveson, who led the inquiry, said there should be a new independent self-regulatory body which crucially would be recognised in law. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 33 minutes past six here in the UK. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London. Now, from Suzanne Beer to Lars von Trier, Nordic cinema is thriving. To show you how much it's thriving, London will be hosting the first Nordic Film Festival from tomorrow to the 5th of December. With new releases and classics like Festen by Thomas Vinterberg, the festival will celebrate the best of Nordic cinema. Although she's not from Scandinavia, the festival director was based in Copenhagen for a while, and she's here to tell us a bit more about Nordic cinema and about the festival too. Welcome, Sonali Joshi. Nice to have you with us. So tell us, you're not from that part of the world, but clearly you're passionate about it. So a good person to tell us why Nordic cinema. What's so unique about it? What gets you about it?
Well, I've had a personal interest in this area of cinema, I guess, really since I first discovered Thomas Vinterberg's Festen back in 1998 when it was released in the UK. And I guess it was a moment where filmmaking was turned on its head and we were presented with something new, I guess, similar to if you go back in history, the moment when the French New Wave started. It was a kind of moment that was really exciting. And from there, there's been all sorts of exciting work, but quite diverse and quite wide-ranging, that's come from the region. But that also comes on the back of many decades of very high-quality storytelling and strong traditions in storytelling from the Nordic countries.
Well, I want to come back to Festen in a second and the sort of movement around it. But tell us, can we say that there are certain themes that define Nordic cinema? Are there certain concerns that it generally has?
I think there are certainly aspects that we've started to become familiar with and that are being loosely termed under this banner of Nordic Noir, which is true. You do get a lot of strong, gritty, realist socialist dramas. And there's definitely a sense of dark, I guess. Mm. But what we're trying to do with this festival is really show that it's not just that. There are many elements of that aspect of Nordic culture and the light and the weather and that's reflected through dark stories.
Well, is that what this is all about? Is it, we're going to be talking, interestingly, about the people who are deprived of sunlight in that part of the world later on in the show, but is that sunlight deprivation for certain times of the year connected to why it seems to deal generally with these quite dark themes?
I guess it's easy to sort of make that connection, but I don't know whether it's really that closely linked. I think the Nordic countries have produced a number of directors who have presented very strong works that have many of these darker themes running through them. But it's not just that. If you look at Nordic storytelling more broadly, you've got long traditions of high-quality children's fiction that's come from the Nordic countries. Mm. So there's a real mixture there, as well as the more noir side of Nordic cinema.
Everybody at the moment is going, talk about the killing, talk about the bridge. What connection for you is there between... I mean, presumably it's a good thing for your festival that so many people are sort of buying these things by the box set, and there's been this real resurgence in the small screen of storytelling from that part of the world.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think everyone loves a good crime story, and what's come from certainly Denmark and Sweden with The Killing, Borgen, The Bridge, these are very high quality TV dramas, and they've resonated very strongly with UK audiences, and they're all programmes that are very technically excellent, great storytelling, and that's connected with UK audiences. And as you rightly say, our festival will kind of build on that and certainly draw from that interest.
Well, let's talk about Festen then. This was the film that got you into cinema from this part of the world. It was famously a sort of, it was the first film of the Dogme movement, which prescribed these sort of authenticity rules to making films that you had to obey. Lots of people said it was a publicity stunt on behalf of this group of directors. But how sort of seismic was that sort of couple of year period for cinema?
I think what Dogma did was it stripped filmmaking to its bare essence, and it looked back in some ways to other strong, influential movements in cinema like French New Wave I've mentioned already, but of that ilk, such that it gave audiences new ways of discovering cinema, and I think it certainly has left an imprint on not just European filmmaking, but international filmmaking more broadly.
Because, I mean, it sort of collapsed quite quickly, didn't it? The sort of the really strict following of the rules. There were only a handful of films that were sort of officially certified, stamped Dogma movies. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. But Thomas Vinterberg himself said in an interview quite recently that it was a certain moment. But of course, filmmaking evolves, and it was just something of that time. But as a director, one evolves also with time, and it was also his first film, and quite an explosive mark on the film world that he made with that.
It's hugely explosive. I mean, do you think that style of filmmaking is particularly relevant now, given that everybody's now a film director and everyone's a film editor with their mobile phones? The fact that the Dogma rules were, you know, handheld cameras, no artificial lighting, everything being authentic. Is it sort of particularly relevant now, do you think?
I think it is, certainly, because it shows audiences that we can tell our own stories too. Mm. It's not just about the technicalities behind filmmaking, but couple that with strong storytelling, and everyone has a story in them, certainly.
Do you think this your festival is going on in London, of course? Do you think that the British sort of disposition is particularly well suited to enjoy the types of stories that are told in this part of the world?
Well, I think certainly in terms of the crime fiction genre that really has taken off in this country in terms of the Nordic stories and fiction that has come out recently, I think there have always been traditions of crime fiction in the UK anyway. So it's that whole thing of, you know, we all like a good crime story, a good murder mystery. And when it's told very well, with great visuals and strong characters, it resonates with you.
Sonali, before you go, remind us where and when we can enjoy your film festival.
The festival opens tomorrow at Ciné Lumière, and it will run until the 5th of December, and it will also screen at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith and also the Prince Charles Cinema in central London.
Sonali Joshi, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with an invention that could possibly change the way we fly.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
You're listening to Midori House, where the time is 5.42 in Sydney and 18.42 here in London. And anyone who's recently completed the 24-hour endurance test that is travelling between Australia and the UK will be familiar with the dehydration, the sleep disruption and the overexposure to Hollywood's weaker offerings that goes with being in a plane for a day. So there's tentative excitement amongst the frequent flyers here at Midori House then, and engineering companies claiming a breakthrough which could shrink that journey, indeed shrink any journey on Earth, to less than 4 hours. Small British outfit Reaction Engine says a new design of heat exchanger is the key, and it could be one large step forward for space travel too. Well, to give his view on how seriously we should be taking this new invention, we are joined on the line by Dan Thisdall. He's business editor at Flight Global. Welcome to Midori House, Dan. Thank you for joining us. Perhaps you could start by explaining exactly what has been developed here.
Yeah, what we've got is a heat exchanger. It's like a radiator, basically, that can take air in from the front of an engine, liquidize it, so that's cooling it all the way down to about 150 degrees below zero, so that you've got effectively liquid oxygen, which is what you mix with liquid hydrogen to make a rocket engine. And so they can do that instead of having to carry all the liquid oxygen, which is really heavy, which prevents you from getting up to orbit, frankly. They can just make it as they go and then carry a small amount in tanks that you use for the last part of the journey to space, or if you're way, way up in the atmosphere, you would use some tanked oxygen.
So just to be clear then, traditional engine design means that it's about cooling, that we can't quite cool these engines down enough in order to sort of release their sort of full power. But this company has found a way of providing that cooling, is that right?
No, not exactly. A jet engine this isn't really relevant to a jet engine. You could increase the efficiency somewhat by some of this technology. But the main thing is what you have here is a rocket engine, but it's a rocket engine that can breathe air. So instead of having to tank all the fuel and carry all that weight through the lower part of the atmosphere, it can fly like an aircraft by sucking in air and using that to burn to burn its fuel. So it potentially works. The simple reality is it works. There's a lot of engineering to do to get a serviceable engine, but the the concept works. So it's, in that sense, really, really exciting, because we could either sort of fly at Mach 5.5, very, very high in the altitude, London to Sydney in 4 hours, or if you want to add in some liquid oxygen that you carry, so you have a rocket engine that can function in space, you can carry right on up to orbit. And that's really exciting, because then you come back, land on the runway, do all the stuff the space shuttle was supposed to do, but at least in principle, you could do it really easy and quickly like an airline.
Okay, so that's in principle, and we've got the concept. That's been proved and approved by the ESA as well. How far along is this development in actual production?
Yeah, it's not. It's just been tested on a great big giant rig, you know, out at Abingdon, where Reaction Engines has its laboratories. What they're going to do now is basically they're going back to their investors. They're looking for another £250 million, and they're talking about private money. They're not really expecting government money to kick in here, and they're going to try to develop a working model to show a complete engine that actually works in a form that could, you know, fly an aircraft. And they reckon, and the European Space Agency thinks it's realistic, that, you know, with enough investment, with enough money, basically, you could have such an aircraft flying in 10 to 15 years and then maybe be actually operational by about 2030. So it's out there a ways, but it's not so far on the long horizon that, you know, we shouldn't actually be watching it carefully.
Well, Dan, you said 250 million British pounds. Yep. It's a fairly hefty sum. Let's follow that money then. Who's going to be putting up this money? Are we talking commercial air transport companies, or are we talking about communications companies who want to get satellites up into space?
No, I think we'd be talking about venture capital sort of investors, people who are looking for, a high risk but potentially very high return investment. That should be a big chunk of the money. I suspect a small chunk of it will come from, various government sources, be they European or in the UK here. And then the other potentially interesting investors are commercial engine makers, which would be Rolls-Royce, for example, or GE, if there were some American involvement, Safran maybe in France, these sort of companies that would be looking at this cooling technology as a way possibly to also make a breakthrough in normal jet engines. Conceivably, you could cut maybe up to 10% off the fuel burn of a normal jet engine, which is an absolutely massive increase in its efficiency, by using this technology to pull heat out of the exhaust and then put it back into the working part of the engine, so you get that power back instead of just blowing it all out the back of the engine. So, you know, potentially, I think the first application actually probably will be space flight, but, you know, the normal aero engines actually offer a pretty significant investment prospect, and I think we may well see some interest there.
What sort of application would this greater access to space that this development might give us have? What do we need more access to space for?
Well, the thing about space is that there's a huge amount of things you can do from space safely and easily that are difficult to do on the ground or from aircraft. You know, if you want to observe a disaster scene, for example, or a forest fire or something like that, you want to monitor the weather, you want to monitor ice flows, you want to do all kinds of things like this. The problem is it's very, very expensive to launch the satellite and get it up there. So as a result, the satellites are very expensive. You don't build a satellite that goes up there and lasts for 3, 4, 5 years. You want to try to build a satellite that's going to last 15 years or something. That's really expensive because it costs so much to launch it. If, however, you can get it up to orbit quickly and easily and relatively cheaply, then, of course, more organizations would be looking at using space to provide benefits here on Earth. So there's this bit of a chicken and egg thing, and this is something throughout the aerospace community that's quite significant right now. We are looking for ways to reduce the cost of getting into space. Because if the price is lower, more companies would do it, more organizations would do it.
Dan, we're rocketing towards the top of the hour, so we're going to have to leave it there with you. But thank you very much for that. That was Dan Thisdall, business editor at Flight Global. Before we head to northern Sweden to find out how people are being cheered up by bus stops, more from the same country, this is Ringing by Vanbot. From Sweden, that was Vanbot with Ringing. And we're staying in Sweden on today's Midori House because the fight against seasonal unhappiness has taken a step forward in that country. The new solution for people feeling bummed by a lack of sun is to get on a bus. Lucky inhabitants of Umeå, a town in northern Sweden. Umeå's local energy company has installed so-called SAD lights for seasonal affective disorder in 30 of the town's bus stops last week. Lights may indeed be needed. The town is 500 kilometres north of Stockholm, and currently the daylight only lasts for 5 hours a day. Well, to tell us what the public reaction has been like and how people in northern Sweden have traditionally fought against the dark, I'm joined on the line by Patrik Kraner, news editor of the newspaper Västerbottens Kuriren. Welcome, Patrik, to Midori House. 5 hours of sunlight a day, presumably it gets slightly worse. How urgently are these lights needed?
Well, for some people, I think it's urgent. A lot of people say that they get depressed during the wintertime. I don't know how serious they are, but at least a lot of people speak about the darkness.
How dark is it right now, these days?
Right now, it's pitch black outside. I mean, it gets dark around at 14 hours, so we don't have that much daylight. I mean, you go to the work, it's black outside, and when you go home, it's dark as well.
Presumably, if the local government is putting SAD lights in bus stops, people have already taken to buying SAD lights, the sort of personal ones they can take home. Are they a very successful product in Sweden?
No, I actually they aren't. I heard that they are popular in Finland, but I don't know that. I don't go to Finland that much. But in Sweden, I haven't heard of people using them. So we only have them at kind of spas and those places. We have some daylight light rooms where you're supposed to get energy and, yeah, that kind of stuff.
Well, this is the thing. In this country, we refer to them as SAD lights. You, I noticed, call them energy lights. So is it sort of well established that there is a need for an increased amount of energy at this rather dark time of year?
Yeah, a lot of people go away during winter time for a vacation to have some sun to fill up the reserves or something like that, but some people can't afford that and they just stay home and complain about it.
Or now they can just go down to their local bus stop and hang out there,
yeah,
can't they?
Exactly.
So describe for us how these bus stop based lights work.
Yeah, they're on, I think, 24/7 for just 3 weeks, and it's really bright. It's supposed to be like a cloudy summer day, the amount of light. So it's quite light, but they have recently, I think it was yesterday, they have put on some screen to filter it a little bit, so it's not that bright anymore.
Oh, I see. People complaining that it was too sunny under the SAD lights. Honestly, there's no pleasing some people. And what will happen to these SAD lights when the sun comes back up and the days get a lot longer?
I don't know. We'll have to ask the energy company. Maybe they use them next year. I don't know. It's quite. We have had a festival here in Umeå for a couple of years. That's called Autumn Light in English, where they have a lot of light installations. It's kind of arty.
Okay. Patrick, sorry to interrupt you there. Just before you go, I want to get one quick tip from you. What are your personal tips for banishing unhappiness in the dark months? What do you do?
What I do? I watch a lot of sports. Premier League.
There we go. Sport is the answer to seasonal affective disorder. Patrick Craner, news editor of Västerbottens Kuriren, thank you very much. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippi, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Next up, it's part two of the Urbanist Does Size Matter series. I'm Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for joining us.